pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane that everybody said would kill you, and the one that refused to die. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar, the show where we sit with the old iron and let it talk. And today the old iron has a name painted right there on the nose: flak bait. Two words. And behind those two words is one of the most remarkable survival stories in all of military aviation. Now, before we climb into that cockpit, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friends, if there was ever an airplane that earned its coin, it's the one we're talking about today. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's go back. The airplane is the Martin B-26 Marauder. Say that name to a pilot who flew in the Second World War and watch his face, because the Marauder had a reputation and it was an ugly one. Here's where it gets interesting. The B-26 was built by the Glenn L. Martin Company out of Baltimore, and it was on paper a beautiful piece of engineering. Fast, the fastest medium bomber America had when it rolled out. A sleek, cigar-shaped fuselage, a nose like a rifle bullet, twin Pratt and Whitney R-2800 double wasp engines hanging off the wings, each one throwing out around 1,800 horsepower. But here's the thing the engineers did. To get that speed, they gave it a small wing. A short, stubby wing with very little area for the weight it had to carry. Aviation people call that high wing loading. What it meant in plain English is that the Marauder had to be flown fast all the time. It came on to final approach at speeds that would make a bomber pilot's palms sweat, someplace up around 130, 140 miles an hour when other airplanes were floating down at 90. And if you lost an engine on takeoff in those early models, that little wing did not want to keep you flying. The airplane would roll toward the dead engine and put you into the ground before you had time to say a prayer. So what happened? Young pilots, fresh out of training, coming to this hot, unforgiving airplane, started dying. Not in combat, in training. Down at MacDill Field in Tampa, they crashed so many into the water of Tampa Bay that the men coined a bitter little rhyme. One a day in Tampa Bay. That's what they said, one a day in Tampa Bay. They gave the airplane names the Widowmaker, the Flying Prostitute, because they joked it had no visible means of support, meaning that tiny wing, the Baltimore Whore, the Martin Murderer. There was even a move in Congress to cancel the whole program and shut Martin down. Now here's where it gets interesting, and this is the part I love. They didn't cancel it. Instead, they sent a man to fix the problem, and the man they sent was none other than Jimmy Doolittle. Doolittle took that airplane up, and he flew it the way it needed to be flown. He'd take off, and then at low altitude, right in front of a crowd of terrified student pilots, he would deliberately shut down one engine, feather the prop, and fly the whole pattern on one fan. Land it, take off again on one engine. He proved that the airplane was not a killer. The airplane was honest. It simply demanded that you respect the numbers. Fly the speeds. Keep your airspeed up. Don't get lazy, don't get slow, and it will bring you home. And the training changed. They stretched the wing a little on later models, added some span to ease that landing speed. And most of all, they taught the pilots the truth about the machine. And once the crews learned to fly it right, the Marauder turned into something extraordinary. By the end of the war, the B-26 Marauder had the lowest combat loss rate of any American bomber in the European theater. Let that sink in. The airplane they called the Widowmaker came home more often than any other bomber we flew. The airplane everybody wanted to cancel outlived its own bad name. Now, let me introduce you properly to our airplane. In April of 1943, one Marauder rolled out of the Martin plant in Omaha, Nebraska. She went to the 459th Bombardment Squadron of the 322nd Bombardment Group, and a crew chief named Jim Farrell gave her a name. He'd heard the anti-aircraft fire called flak, from a long German word for aircraft defense gun, and he had a little dog back home named Flak Bait, so that's what he painted on her nose, Flak Bait. It turned out to be about the most fitting name any airplane ever wore. Picture the scene. It's 1943 and 44, and Flak Bait is flying out of England and later out of France and Belgium, hitting bridges, marshalling yards, gun positions, V-1 rocket launch sites along the coast, medium altitude work, down where the flak could reach you. Down where the gunners on the ground could see you and range you and throw everything they had. And they did. Oh, they did. Close your eyes and put yourself in that cockpit. It's cold. Your oxygen mask is chafing your face. The two double wasps are hammering away on either side of you, a deep, ceaseless roar that you feel in your teeth. The smell is a mix of avgas and hydraulic fluid and hot oil and the rubber of your mask. Ahead of you, over the target, the sky is stitched with black puffs. Each one is a shell. Each puff you can see is one that already went off, and the ones that matter are the ones you never see. And flak bait flies straight into it, because a bomb run means you hold your heading, straight and level, no jinking, while the bombardier does his work and the whole world tries to kill you. And they hit her, again, and again, and again. Over the course of the war, flak bait was struck by enemy fire more than 1,000 times. More than 1,000 holes. She came home one day with over 200 holes in her from a single mission. She lost engines over the target and flew home on one. Her hydraulic system got shot out. Her electrical system got shot out. Her rudder was shredded. Twice she limped back with an engine dead and feathered. Her crews were wounded in her seats, and every single time that honest, hard-flying, hot-landing airplane brought her men home. By the time the shooting stopped in Europe, flak bait had flown 207 combat missions. 207. That was more than any other American aircraft in the entire European theater of the Second World War. Not another bomber, not a fighter, nothing flew more combat missions and survived than this one battered marauder. Now here's where it gets interesting one more time. When the war ended, most of these airplanes met a sad fate. The marauders, thousands of them, got flown out to boneyards and scrapyards and chopped up for aluminum. An entire type, an airplane that helped win a war, very nearly vanished from the earth. Today, there are only a handful of B-26 marauders left anywhere in the world, a tiny handful. You can count them without taking off your gloves. But somebody, thank God, had the sense to look at flak bait and understand what she was, her nose section. That famous nose with the name and the long, long rows of little bomb symbols painted on for every mission flown was cut away and preserved and sent home to the Smithsonian, and over the years the rest of her came too. For a long time she sat in storage, that legendary nose displayed on its own while the rest of her waited in pieces. And that brings us to why she's in the news and why I wanted to talk about her today. Out at the Smithsonian's Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center, the big companion facility to the National Air and Space Museum out by Dulles Airport in Virginia, the conservators have been doing something painstaking and beautiful. They've been putting flak bait back together. And I want to be careful with the word here, because this matters. They are not restoring her the way we restore a warbird to fly. When you and I restore an airplane, we strip her down, we replace what's rotten, we make her shiny and new and better than she came from the factory. That's restoration, and I love it. This is different. This is conservation. The Smithsonian's approach is to preserve the actual airplane, the real thing, with all of her wounds. They are cleaning her, stabilizing her, dealing with corrosion that's been quietly eating at her for decades. But they are keeping the patches, they are keeping the repairs her ground crews made in the field with whatever they had. They are keeping the flak damage, because every one of those 1,000+ holes is a piece of the truth, and you cannot fake it and you cannot buy it, and once it's gone forever. The conservators found things inside her that had been sealed up since 1945, original grease pencil markings, a crewman's scribbled notes, bits of the actual mud and grime of wartime England still in her recesses, sludge in her lines. One report described finding period debris tucked in places no restorer had ever disturbed. They're documenting all of it, photographing all of it, treating that airplane less like a machine and more like an archaeological site that happens to have wings. It is slow, careful, loving work. The kind of work that doesn't make a lot of noise. And when it's finished, the whole airplane, not just the nose, will stand assembled for the public to walk around and look up at the most combat-flown American aircraft of the war, wearing every scar she earned, honest to the last rivet. Now, I'll be straight with you. There's an old argument in this hobby, and you've heard me grumble about it before. Should a warbird fly, or should she sit in a museum, and most days you know where I land? I want to hear the engines, I want to smell the smoke, I believe an airplane wants to fly, and that a flying warbird teaches more than a static one ever could. But flak bait. Flak bait is the exception that makes me hold my tongue. Because there is only one of her. There will never be another airplane that flew 207 missions and lived. If you rebuilt her to fly, you would have to cut away the damage, sand out the history, replace the wounded skin, and the day you did that, the real flak bait would be gone and you'd have a beautiful replica wearing a dead woman's name. Some airplanes belong to the sky, this one belongs to memory, and the Smithsonian is keeping her exactly, precisely, painstakingly as she came home. Bless them for it. So next time you're near Dulles, out at the Udvar-Hazy Center, go find her. Stand under that nose. Read the name Jim Farrell painted for a little dog back home. Count the bomb symbols if you've got the afternoon. And put your hand near, not on, near one of those flak scars, and think about a 19-year-old holding heading straight and level into a wall of steel because the mission said hold heading. That's who she carried. That's who she brought home. 207 times. My thanks today to the folks at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum and their conservation team out at the Udvar Hazy Center, whose published work on the Flak Bay Project told this story, and to the historians of the Glenn L. Martin Aviation Legacy, who kept the Marauder's record straight. You can always find us at radiohangar.com. This is Tail Dragger. Keep the honest ones flying, and keep the sacred ones exactly as they came home. I'll see you next time.